If you've been with us any amount of time through our study in Ecclesiastes, you might have asked yourself at different points as we've been looking at some, I don't want to say despairing thoughts, but, you know, Solomon is writing from a perspective that you often think, like, do you have any joy in your life? Do you have any hope in what you're thinking through? But you might have asked yourself at different points, what's the point of what we do? I mean, Solomon has been looking at these different aspects of life, whether it's our knowledge, our wisdom, the possessions that we have, the goals of our life, the work that we are searching after. And again, he comes to this conclusion that it's all vanity. It's all a puff of smoke. And when you look at it from that perspective, it's easy to think, what is the point in what we do? And I think that's a question that a lot of people are asking in our world. It's not just a question that we're asking because we're opening Ecclesiastes and dealing with the text that Solomon is writing for us. But it's a question that I think people are asking all around us. What is the point in what I'm doing? Some feel like they never get ahead and that they're always settling for less. And others, in the never-ending pursuit of advancement, in the accumulation of wealth and status, pour wholeheartedly in what they do and chasing something that always just seems to be right out of grasp. Never before have we seen the transient nature of career than we have in the last 10 years, especially in the last 4 years. More and more people have left jobs, left school, changed jobs, went back to school, reimagined their future, and have been kind of shifting more than any other time in recent history. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, my grandparents, like my dad's dad was a railroad mechanic, and that's what he did for his whole life. He worked on the railroad. And I mean, that was, if you knew, my dad's nickname is Smokey, not because he smokes. It's just Smokey because his dad's nickname was Smokey. And if you knew Smokey, he was at the railroad station and he was working on the railroad cars all the time. That's what he did for a career. My mom's dad was a fireman and he worked in the fire hall. And that's what he did his whole life. You ask a person what they've done for their career today, they'll say, can you give me 15 minutes to rattle off all the things that I've done? It just seems like the amount of change that people are processing in their career is at an ever rapid pace. People that go to school and get a degree, they're not using it. They're barely even scratching the surface of what they've studied to be able to carry them in their career because they feel like they're moving in a different direction. Statistics say that the average person will change careers 7 to 11 times in their life. 7 to 11 times. And that number is rapidly increasing. In the pursuit of meaning and purpose, in all of this nebulous chaos concerning what we do, I believe Solomon is offering some help as we make our way through this world. Now, remember the premise of Ecclesiastes. Solomon is examining life under the sun. What is life like under the sun if God is not present or that he's distant? Can we find value in the world that we live in? And Solomon's conclusion again and again has been, it is all vanity and chasing after the wind. But along the way, he will offer these nuggets of wisdom to even help us to carry us through life under the sun. And this morning, we are looking at one of these pearls of wisdom that he offers. We've seen already in Ecclesiastes that our identity is not and cannot be found in our work. Who we are can't be found in what we do. If someone is meeting you for the first time and they say, tell me about yourself, what do? We tell them what we do. This is my job. This is where I earn a living. Solomon says our identity is not found in our work, but that our work is a gift from God. And Ecclesiastes 2:24 pointed us to that. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. That our work is from the hand of God, that God has gifted us. And we discussed this a couple weeks ago, that the purpose of work is so that we stay busy. Solomon clued us into that. The fact that we have to get up and do whatever we do is so that we can stay busy in a world where idleness will lead to trouble and problems. So rather than throwing up his hands altogether, Solomon is assessing the situation of where work fits as he explores life under the sun. This morning, we're going to consider his findings, that having a proper perspective in how we think about our work. Remember, this is where you're going to spend a third of your life. You better have a good understanding of where work fits in your world. Because if you don't understand and truly appreciate the opportunities that God is giving you to embrace the work that is given from his hand, you're going to waste your life. And Solomon is pointing us to the fact and to the truths that even under the sun, God doesn't want us to waste our lives. There's purpose. And we profit materially and immaterially from the place that work has in our life. It's not all for naught. There is a purpose for it. Now, this overall section that we're looking at, beginning in verse 4 and ending in verse 16 of chapter 4, is really one big thought unit. And we know that because there are some clues in the text that point that way. There's a technique that he's using as a writer where he is bracketing the truth of what he's pointing us to. And the fact of that is he uses this phrase in verse 4 when he says, "This too is vanity and striving after wind." And then in verse 16, when he concludes by saying, "This too is vanity and striving after wind." And everything included in the middle of those brackets is all the same thought unit. And so Solomon's inviting us to consider what we do under the sun. In many ways, it seems like a puff of smoke. It's here one minute, it's gone the next. I mean, think about this. The investment that many of you have made in your careers, and I'm not trying to frustrate you in what you've done, but within a generation or two, it's really not going to matter. It's not. It's gone. Because you're gone too. Now, I'm not saying go to work tomorrow and tell your boss to take this job and shove it. But don't tie who you are into what you do, because what you do likely isn't going to carry on beyond even a year after you retire. But Solomon's giving us purpose. And we need that purpose. We need the eternal value to understand what's going on. Because along the way of this life, as we are making our way through this world, really sweating and laboring and going through all the ins and outs of the joys and frustrations that come with our vocations, Solomon wants us to understand, as we pursue our work, that there is value that can be given to us if we properly put everything in perspective. He's giving us advice here. What should drive us in what we do is not about what we can gain or what we can get out of it. Solomon is going to give us three main points this morning. And I just love the fact that there's three easy points in this passage. Because as a pastor that studies the Bible every week, sometimes it's a little harder to get to those easy, reachable points where you can just say, "Oh, there it is." The first thing that he says is that we shouldn't be living for our work, but we should be living with a heart of contentment. So as we work with a heart of contentment. The second thing that Solomon says is, as we work, we should work with a partnership of with people. We should work with a partnership with people. And all the while, as we develop a heart of contentment and have a partnership with people, Solomon concludes and says we should have a teachable spirit. We put these three ingredients in place in our lives as we consider the place that work has in our life. We will do very well. If you work with the idea of having a heart of contentment, that whatever you do will provide exactly what you need to make it through this world, you'll be fine. And along the way, if you work with people, not just by yourself, accumulating for yourself, but working with others, you'll be in a safe place in what you do. And finally, along the way, as you're working through this world, whether you are brand new in what you're doing or you've been doing it your whole life, if you have a teachable spirit, it will help you along the way in what you do. And so the first thing that Solomon asks us to consider is having a heart of contentment. This is what he says in verses 4 through 6. Hear the word of God as Solomon writes about the purpose of our work. I've seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One hand is full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after wind. You understand what he's saying, right? I don't need to comment on this. I read this and I'm thinking, these seem like strange, isolated thoughts, one from the next. It's like he's going through, it's almost like in Proverbs, when you read Proverbs and you have these statement after statement of something. And it's like, Solomon, did you hear what you're writing? Because I don't quite understand the flow. But here in Ecclesiastes, what Solomon is doing is he's walking us through a progression. He shares with us two big extremes that exist when we think about our work. There's one extreme where we devote everything that we have to what we do, and there's another extreme where we do nothing. And then he wraps up in showing us these extremes. He gives us a moderated view, a better view for us to understand the place that work has in our lives. So the first extreme is what he says in verse 4. Solomon observes, and he had the ability to observe as king over the nation of Israel. He had the time and the investment of resources and the ability to look at the many subjects that he had. He observed that much of our work is due to rivalry. Much of what we do is due to rivalry. Solomon observes that much of our work is done because of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. The word rivalry that Solomon uses is better translated as jealousy or envy. So Solomon's observation is much of our work as people are working in the world that they live is motivated by jealousy or envy. Now the reality is that our work can be distorted by sin. We need to understand that as fallen people, we're not approaching things in a perfect way. We're not looking at what we do through the perfect lens of a holy life. And so we're motivated by motivations that are in a sinful heart that pull us in many different directions. And Solomon looks at what we do and he says, much of what we accomplish in this world is because we are jealous or we envy. Envy isn't just wanting possessions. That's coveting. Like, I'm not just working because I want something new, bright, and shiny. No, Solomon kind of goes deeper because envy conveys something else, something deeper that's tied into the heart. Envy is a feeling of discontentment over someone else's possessions. It's when you don't want someone else to have what they've been given. And what drives and motivates many people in their career is to keep up with the Joneses. This never-ending pursuit. Because you look at what other people have and say, I want that for myself. And you're frustrated that you don't have it. And while you might be sitting here in church saying, listen, I don't go to work Or I don't work to have what my neighbor has. And you're trying to give us the Sunday school spiritual answer. In reality, we need to be honest with ourselves that Solomon observes that our work often is driven by the feeling of getting ahead and trying to at least keep up or outpace those around us. Now, this feeling that is rooted in our hearts that compels many to work hard in what they do fits very well into a capitalistic society. This motivation to get ahead and work harder, to get more, often creates a thriving economy. If I were to run for office, Ecclesiastes 4:4 would be one of my mottos. Let's just tap into the envy that we have and what we do, and that will help the economy that we live in, because everyone will be just driving forward. But the danger of this approach of working solely to outpace out of a heart of envy is, when will you ever have enough? When will it ever be enough? When you're in a rivalry between your neighbor, when will it cease? And it's not like it's I'm against you, like you name them by name, but you know what it's like if you pull into your house and you see your neighbor has something new and bright and shiny, and you think, oh, I need one of those new bright shiny things. Or you hear the news from your neighbor that, you know, they're moving and they got the bigger house that has more land, and you think, boy, I haven't thought about it in a while, but I could use a new house and more land. You know, it's that kind of idea, that this rivalry that exists in our hearts and drives us and motivates us in what we do. So when will it ever be enough? I mean, how many of you, and there's more here than not, have the ability to look back? You're looking back over a longer period of time when you began your work career, and you thought, once I get to this point, I know I'll have enough. And you know, you start out in your new career, and you know, you're making pittance to just survive, and you think, boy, if I just get that promotion, or I get more training, or I'm able to rise up in the ladder of whatever I'm doing, once I get to this point, I know it's going to be enough. And then you get to that point and you start thinking, well, there's a little more I could have. And then your boss says to you, hey, you're doing a real good job, and we want to give you a promotion and a raise. And how many of you have said, you know, I really don't need it, I don't want it, you just take it yourself because I'm content. Like, that's a hard thing. Those are hard things to wrestle with. But we all go through that journey, that process. The other extreme of not just working because of rivalry is what Solomon says in verse 5. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. The other extreme of working hard is folding your hands. It's being lazy. It's doing nothing. It's the refusal to work. Now, some of you are sitting here saying, oh, I know a bunch of young people that just fold their hands all day long. You know, that kind of thing. Like, and it's always easy, it's the low-hanging fruit, to look at the people behind us and say, oh, they don't have the work ethic that we have. No, I know a lot of young people that are very driven in what they do. They're very focused in what they do, and they're very good at what they do. So it's not just a generational problem. It's a societal problem, that you always have people that work too hard on one extreme, and you have, on the other hand, people that don't care at all. And maybe they've resigned themselves and they've said, you know, it's impossible to keep up with the Joneses, so I'm just going to stay right here. And this is what Solomon says. The danger in folding your hands is that you consume your own flesh. What does that mean? Well, your laziness deprives you of the resources that you need to survive. And so by the very effort of folding your hands and sitting idly by, you're not able to take care of yourself. One commentator wrote by saying, another way you can translate verse 5 is saying, all they do is fold their lazy hands. Both of these extremes, Solomon says, are vanity and chasing after the wind. If there is value in work under the sun, both ends of the spectrum will not lead to a productive outcome. Do you see that? Like, that's really important for us to hear this morning and see in the text. that it's not just laziness that's the problem, because that's easy to say, oh yeah, you know, we should work. But the other extreme of working so hard and accumulating things, that is not valuable either. It does not lead to a productive outcome. To toil and work hard to gain what others have, or to cannibalize yourself through idleness, are wrong pursuits of work. And so to help, Solomon offers a moderate perspective. Verse 6. One handful of rest is better than two fists full of labor in striving after wind. Or this too is striving after the wind. So this is what Solomon says. Two fists of labor, going all in, letting your work be your identity, letting your work consume your calendar, is an endless pursuit. And two fists full of labor isn't going to get you there. And then conversely, two fists full of rest, idleness, isn't going to get you there either. One handful of rest is better than two fists full of labor. So rather than trying to grab all that you can in life through your effort, Solomon says that it's better to have balance in our lives. And you're sitting there this morning saying, I know, that's obvious. The danger is we know things, but we don't apply things. To work hard. But don't forget to rest along the way. Rest is critical to your success in what you do. We live in a time in the world where, as a world, as a people, we have depleted margin in our life. You know what I mean by margin, right? If margin is the space around the paper, you know, like when you were in school and the teacher said, leave 1-inch margins all around. We are a people that are living right up to the edge. We have no space in our lives. We're often too busy. We're too consumed with what we're doing. And we do not take time to rest. We don't. We call it vacation, but then we're so busy on vacation, we never really rest. Rest is a gift from God. Rest is God's gift to mankind. God showed us the pattern of rest when He created the world in 6 days. And on the seventh day, He rested. Does God need to rest? No. But He knows us. And He sets a pattern for us. And He says, do likewise. Jesus took time to rest. He got away from the crowds. He would often be ministering and serving people. And then you would read in the next episode, He would get on the boat and go to the other side of the sea and be isolated. And He and His Father were in communion with one another. Church, your rest isn't just your day off from work. Your rest can rejuvenate you physically, but it should also be helping you to rest spiritually, to rejuvenate your soul as you worship the Lord. I know this seems like a very pastorly thing to say. But if you're not making time to rest in the presence of community as you come before the Lord Jesus Christ, you are in imbalance. And you are dangerously getting close to erasing the margin that could be in your life. And so I caution you carefully to make time, not to just take a nap, but make time to rest in the goodness of Jesus Christ with God's people and in solitude using all the opportunities that you have to embrace the person of the Lord. If you're too busy to make time to worship and to celebrate God through the rest that He provides you, then you need to check your motivation when it comes to why you do what you do. You know, there's that statement or the maybe it's a song and maybe I'm getting it mixed up, right? Everybody's working for the weekend. Is that a song? Okay. You don't have to sing it, but you know, it's this idea that, right, we look at Mondays as like the worst day of the week and we think, Friday's here. Everyone's working for the weekend, you know, so we can just cut the line and be free to do whatever we want. And then, you know, Friday night becomes busy and Saturday we get things done. And then Sunday we're so busy, we either think, I got to get all the other things done that I wasted on the weekend to do and I can't worship the Lord. Or I need to take a nap on Sunday and sleep in because I haven't given myself any rest and we're missing the rest that Jesus wants us to have. And studies have shown to prove this. In the 1970s, there was a study that was done that revealed that a growing mature Christian attended 3 services a week. Sunday morning, usually Sunday evening, and usually Wednesday or a midweek Bible study. 3 services a week. The same study was done recently and then showed that a growing mature Christian attends 3 services a month. So then going from 12, we're going to 3. And it makes us wonder why there is such a breakdown in the spiritual maturity in many churches. We've got to make time to be with God's people, the family that He has called us to belong to, and to worship the Lord and to grow together in the study of His Word and encourage each other and to pray for one another and to stand in the gap for each other, to hold each other accountable, to exhort, to encourage, to admonish, to all the things that that Jesus called us to be in the family of God and that the apostles like Paul and Peter and John wrote letters to help take care of the body that Jesus laid down His life for. Does one another's mean together? Our work and our play and our busyness has gotten in the way of resting in the presence of the Lord. To be at rest, this is what Solomon says in verse 6, one handful of rest. That word rest means to be calm or patient. And so to find balance between work and rest then means to be content in what you do and what you have. To be at rest means I don't need to work the extra hours to take away time, not just from resting in the presence of Jesus, but having balance in my life to be able to breathe a little bit and to enjoy the world that I live in. Your boss doesn't care if you work 80 or 120 hours a week for your good. It's for their bottom line. And if you own the company and you're working 80 or 120 hours a week, I'm going to invite you to consider something. Make the investment to bring some other people in your life to help you with that load. Help unburden yourself with that task so that you can breathe a little bit. Find margin in your life. A handful of rest is better than 2 fists full of labor. Now This leads us to the second area. Second area is a partnership with people, verses 7 through 12. This is what Solomon writes. Then I looked again at vanity under the sun. There was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, "And for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is vanity, and it is a grievous task. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if 2 lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, 2 can resist him. A cord of 3 strands is not quickly torn apart." A partnership with people is crucial in the ability of what you do to help you and sustain you as you make your way through this world. Solomon speaks of the very real danger in the pursuit of what we do that we can convince ourselves it is better to work alone. I don't know if you're like me, and I can go through seasons of this where I feel like it's better to do it myself, because I think if I do it myself, it'll be done the right way. Okay, some of you are like me, right? Because if you turn it over to someone else, then you have to kind of watch and be like, yeah, I wouldn't do that. And you know, as I train my son and my daughter, and, you know, they're in this time of life where, you know, I ask them to do something, and then I'm just kind of watching, and, you know, they're going to do it wrong. They're going to do it wrong, and I'm going to have to fix it. You know, my wife is very good at just kind of like reminding me, like putting her hand on my back and saying, calm down. It's going to get done. It might not get done your way, but it's going to get done. And that's part of that challenge, right? In being able to hand things off to people and then think about what you do for a living, what you invest your time in, what you're making a living from. Solomon says there is a very real danger of working alone. He looked at again at vanity under the sun. The man without a dependent. This man had no children, no family to leave anything that he was working hard for. And Solomon observed that there was no end to his riches. There's no end to his riches. His eyes were not satisfied with the riches that he had. And he rhetorically asks himself, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? Why am I working myself to death? No one is benefiting. It kind of reminded me as I was reading this of the Charles Dickens Christmas Carol with Scrooge, Ebenezer Scrooge. Now, I wasn't thinking of the classic Dickens story. My mind went to two places. First, it went to Scrooge McDuck and Mickey's adaptation of the Christmas Carol. And it went to the 1980s movie with Bill Murray, Scrooged. Like, you know, these people that just invest all of their time and effort in what they do, but it's not benefiting anyone. And they have no time to even enjoy it because all they're doing is work, 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 work. The thought that accumulating wealth will provide status and purpose, but there is nothing to share with others. The labor is for themselves and they work more and more, but they're unable to enjoy the pleasure of their work. And so an honest question to ask yourself when you think about your life in these terms is, for whom am I working? For whom am I working? Am I working for myself and myself alone to advance, or am I working for the purposes and the glory of God and to benefit other people? And see, the person that forsakes community for the sake of gaining wealth will never have enough. Their eyes are never filled. They always want more, and they can never enjoy it. So for who are you working in life? Solomon's advice, two are better than one. Now that makes sense, right? How many of you have to rake leaves this time of year? Or blow leaves, or mulch leaves, or do whatever. Isn't it always better when you have more than one person helping you in the task of raking and dragging and doing whatever you do with the leaves? Or any project that you do around the house. Isn't it awesome when someone just steps alongside of you and says, can I help with that? And that's not a subtle message to my kids to say that next time we're doing something. It's just that life in general. If someone offers help, two are better than one. Togetherness is better than loneliness. Connection is better than competition. This verse and the others that follow are not about marriage. And I hate to burst your bubble. If you had, you know, Ecclesiastes 4:12, a cord of three strands is quickly not torn apart and all that. It's not about marriage. It's about work. Now, it could be about the work that is done in a marriage, but it's not just a verse that we're to read at a wedding service. Connection is better than competition. When two people work together well, they are more productive in their work. There's a good return for their labor. This is true in every facet of our work, not just what we do vocationally, but what we can do in ministry and what we can accomplish in our neighborhoods. Like if we have the good news of the gospel, think about it when a church gets excited about that good news and doesn't just send an evangelist or just the pastor or just one person to go out with the good news. Think about a church reaching out to its community with the good news. Like when Jesus sent out the disciples in pairs, think about the effectiveness of things like that. Paul understood that. And even though he is lauded for his dedication to preaching the gospel to the Gentiles, Paul acknowledged all along the way that he never did it alone. As he wrote his letters that he wrote to the New Testament churches, he always took time to thank the people that were with him and supported him in ministry. A partnership is crucial because Solomon knows that it is easy to get knocked down in our efforts. We all know what that's like, right? It could be something that you're doing at home. And do you ever, what is it, Murphy's Law, right? That term that whatever could go wrong goes wrong in a situation. Do you ever come across that when you're trying to do something at home? And if you're doing it by yourself, it can be an exceedingly frustrating thing to look at a situation and say, I don't know how I'm going to be able to accomplish this. But then you think about what you do for a vocation. And when you have someone standing with you, and the hits are going to come, you're going to fall, you have someone there to pick you up. What a gift it is when we have someone to pick us up when we fall. That we're not alone to try to figure it out on our own. I tragically learned recently about a pastor that I respect for their dedication to the gospel that had a tragic fall, like in the last month. For the last 5 years, 5 years especially, in his ministry life, he was spending up to 25 weeks away from home, traveling not with his wife, traveling not with his elders of his church, but going from place to place, speaking at conferences. And he was engaged in an immoral affair. And you read about these things and it grieves your heart and it makes you wonder, like, how can someone get to that point? But when you go it alone and you don't have people in your life to hold you accountable, a companion or companions that will work with you, love you, support you, encourage you, confront you, exhort you, pray for you, and hold you accountable, it's easy to fall. Two are better because they also, as Solomon says, keep us warm. That's not a marriage verse. In the ancient world that Solomon was writing to, it was a scary place to travel. Like you left the town walls of a city that you were in to go somewhere else. You were in the wilderness. It was a dangerous place. And they didn't have Motel 6s along the way for you to stop at. So Solomon says, if you have a companion with you, you can sleep back to back and be warm. Some of you will judge us for this statement, and that's okay because I know Jesus loves me and he's okay with it. Our dog sleeps in the bed with us. Some of you are like, I need to find another church right now. And that's okay. I'll tell you what, though. There are nights where that dog is, like, on fire. And it's like, I wake up and I'm thinking, did someone turn the thermostat up? Because it is blazing hot. And I'm like, oh, it's just Rooney. And it's like, oh. I get out and I'm like, Panna, I need a drink of water. But two are better than one because when you're sleeping with someone, it helps keep you warm. Now, I want to be careful and not spiritualize this too much, but I believe there's a warning through this encouragement for us today that when a Christian tries to go through life on their own, they are in real danger of becoming spiritually cold. There's a real danger if you try to live the Christian life by yourself. Church, there is spiritual warmth in going through life with other believers. We need each other. We need to pick each other up when we fall. There is safety in numbers. We talked about this a few months ago when we were studying 1 Peter. We know, according to 1 Peter 5:8, that there's an adversary, the devil, prowling around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. And if you've ever watched this, and we talked about this when we talked about this verse, when you look at lions attacking, who do they usually focus on? The ones on the outskirts, the ones outside of the community. And they pick off those weak, wounded animals on the fringes. There is safety for us in the faith when we're committed to a local church. It's good and protective for you to be together with others of like-minded faith. When it comes to facing these spiritual dangers, two are better than one. If we live close with other believers, there's always someone to stand with us in the fight and to cover us with the protection of prayer. And so I encourage you to move into the community that we have here at North Anvil Bible Church. Like, we're not talking about just attending church. This is very passive. It's important. God has ordained it, and we rejoice in it. But this is not the be-all, end-all of the community that God is calling us to. God wants us to share life together, to be in community with one another, to extend the relationships that we have beyond the walls of a Sunday morning worship service. And so I encourage you to get involved in a life group, one of our small groups that we have, or a Bible study, one of our fellowship opportunities. I didn't hear anything about the Uno night last night. How did that go? Awesome. Do we know who won? Did we even keep track? The men won. Well, very humble that you didn't announce that this morning. So, but like, even things like that are important. They're really important just to build life with other people. And then Solomon concludes and he says, a cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. And while we recite this at a wedding service, this verse reminds us that strength exists in community. If two are good, what happens when you add a third? Exponentially stronger. And so if you build a community around you, you find great strength in that. And so we've been looking at these challenges of having a heart of contentment, of building partnerships, and finally, have a teachable spirit. Verses 13 through 16. A poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. For he has come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. I've seen all the living under the sun. I have seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. There is no end to all people, to all who were before them, and even the ones who will come later will not be happy with them, for this too is vanity and striving after the wind. And so what Solomon does is he teaches us through an analogy of a poor yet wise lad compared to a king who has served a long time. And the poor man continued to grow in instruction compared to the king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. Some speculated who Solomon seems to be writing about. This wasn't his experience. Solomon didn't grow up poor and in prison. Some maybe say he's talking about his dad, who was a poor shepherd, David. And then until he ascended to the throne, had to run from King Saul and was in all some kinds of crazy situations. Or some think that he was also referring to Joseph from the book of Genesis, who was sold into slavery and then thrown into jail. And then he was called out of that and ascended to be prime minister of the nation of Egypt. And we're not sure exactly where this thought was driven from. But what we do know is that it's a rags-to-riches story about a man who rose to success from obscurity to royalty. And the lesson is that it's better to be a poor person who accepts wisdom and grows in instruction than to be an old king and thinks that you know it all. Well, I don't know if you've ever been around people like that. I don't know if you are one of those people. But having a teachable spirit is the key to success in life under the sun. Be teachable. The throng sides with the wise when they replace the old and long-serving king. From an under-the-sun perspective, there is no end to all people. They just keep coming, and this too is vanity and striving after the wind. And so if God is calling you to a place in what you do to be effective, it's going to come with training and learning and listening and asking questions and watching and observing and evaluating all of these good things. You never get to the point where you're like, you know, I got to figure it out. Here's what I have found in my own life. When you get to the place where you think you have it figured out, watch for the fall. It just seems to come right after. It's like I get to the place in my mind where I think it's all good, and then it's not. And so lean into those who do what you do and learn and watch and listen and ask questions. Whether you're just starting out or whether you've been there a good long time, you never get to the point where you know it all. So you never get too old to learn something new. The wisest Christians are the ones who listen to godly counsel and, if necessary, also accept correction. The best way to turn in life is to the Lord Jesus, who is the only King, whose fame will last forever. To be a Christian, then, is to simply be a teachable follower of Him. Oh, that we would have a soft heart to receive instruction. That's where the joy is. That's where the benefit is. So there it is. Solomon's observations on how to be effective in what we do. Be content in the investment of your time. Don't work too hard. And don't be too lazy. Find rest. Second, have a partnership with people. When you fall, and you will, they're there to pick you up. And when you're cold, they're there to keep you warm. And if you add to that group, you'll be stronger than before. And finally, have a teachable spirit. Listen, ask questions, observe what's happening around you. And when you work this way, you will find value in what you do, both for yourself and for the Lord. Let's pray.